Marvin Minders. He is a chief or a veterinary medical officer in the Department of Homeland Security. He received his DVM from the University of Georgia and his MPVM from Cal Davis. He was a rural practitioner before he decided to join the Air Force. Yeah, I followed suit. After going to the Air Force, he kind of demonstrated the variety of what veterinarians and public health people do in the Air Force. In 1986, he was appointed the Chief of Combat Casualty Care, and that's not animal care, that's human care. And he built a computer model to a simulation to model the first and second echelons of care, again, for humans. He was also that model was used to define the Air Force Medical Service's wartime manpower requirements. He was also the first Air Force Medical Service officer to become the Chief of Medical Readiness Division for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And again, that is not something that's usually left for somebody else to do. With that, I think there's a pretty good introduction to talk about veterinary medical planning.
Thank you. I will stay in one position. I got a pinched nerve in my back, so I will not pop. If something goes wrong up there, let me know, because I will not be looking around this morning. It was October 23rd, 1983. It was a beautiful Sunday morning in the wine country in Germany. And not far from there, at Wiesbaden Air Force Base, there was a young surgeon who was on the way to church with his family, and he received a call. And it was a hospital commander. He said, "There's been a bombing in Lebanon, and we do not know the extent of the injuries, but they have called and requested assistance. And so take whatever you need, the people, supplies, and go." And he told me that, you know, basically he went through, he called the people that he knew, that he thought he needed, and went through the medical material warehouse, pulling things off the shelf. So I think I need this, we need this, and this and that. But that was basically the pre-plan that went into this particular crisis action. What they found when they arrived was that there was a truck bomb had gone into the Marine barracks, which I'm sure probably most of y'all have heard. And essentially, it was loaded with about 12,000 pounds of equivalent TNT, and they drove around the barrier and essentially drove into the lobby where it was detonated. And there was 80 people seriously injured, which didn't sound too awfully bad. But if you look, there was 241 that were killed. That ratio, about 3-1, 3 killed per 1 injured, which is unusual. But it was because they actually were able to drive into the building and stuff. So we learned a lot from that. Now let me take you ahead now into June the 25th, 1996. It was about 12:30 in the morning. A phone call came in. At that time, I was on the other end of the phone, and my boss said, "There's been a bombing in Bahrain. We do not know the extent of the injuries, but they've called and requested assistance." So what we found when we arrived was this time it was about 20 to 30,000 pounds of TNT equivalent. And there is a picture. The hole was 35 feet deep, about 85 feet wide. And this picture here gives you that building beside it is 8 stories, so it gives you some way to sort of judge the depth and stuff. But what's different here is that, and this was just some pre-planning and things done. So you see where the detonation occurred. You really can see somewhat of a fence line there. There was barriers that were put up because they were, you know, basically had planned for this type of situation. So it was further away. But this is what the front of the building looked like, even that far away. 19 people killed and 400 injured. Different, certainly a different ratio. But it was still, the injured, it was horrible. Is that one guy was laying on his bed in front of the window when the blast hit, the gap blast blew, and he wasn't injured. But his roommate was sitting across the room in a chair, and he was killed by the glass. Saw patients with glass in their eyes. I mean, it's just a horrible way to be injured and die. But that particular situation, our response was much easier. We had pre-identified people on teams, equipment and modules that were basically ready to go. And what we did that morning was, basically mix and match our capability. Is that field surgical team for the trauma that was going on, critical care team in the air, and the extended air vac crew. One of the reasons that came out of the critical care team was that the surgeon that went, he was escorting the patient back on the plane, and the patient turned, the condition turned sour. They diverted to a hospital, but by the time the plane was landed, the patient had died. And he often has fought with himself on that. Could I have done more? If I had the right equipment, if I had those things, could I have saved his life at that particular time? So what can we learn from the military in this situation? Well, there's many lessons learned, and the good thing about it is that the lessons learned were not filed. They were, action was taken. So many times you say, well, what do you do with your lessons learned? Oh, we file them. You really got to implement those things so that you do learn from your past mistakes. Readiness became a priority during that time. Full-time planners positions were established. There was training programs for them. Started putting things into regulations and into policy so that this is the way you do things. This is the way you establish it. This is the planning that you need to do. And, of course, there were some dollars that followed that, too. And the main thing went to was modulars. So you don't ship a whole thing. It's almost as bad to have too much of what you don't need than not have enough. So you can mix and match and build your asset and send it down incrementally. So why do we need public health planners and what do they do? I think, of course, everybody in this room is well aware of this, but a lot of people are not, is that infectious diseases are emerging and spreading at unprecedented rates with the global traffic. 2 billion people, air passengers per year. That's a lot of movement of people from all various places in the world. Within 24 hours, no matter where you are in the world, you can spread that disease someplace in a major metropolitan center. And an example, more than half of the planet's 20 costliest catastrophes since 1970, that's 40 years ago, all have occurred, half of those have occurred within the last 10 years. An example is SARS, 10,000 people and $60 billion. My message today is really advocating the planner. That is the foundation, the keystone of a program is having a dedicated planner. Here's the person who works the day-to-day issues. If you're going to be successful and move a program along, you need somebody who goes out there and kicks the tires every day. And, hey, I'm responsible. If something goes wrong, it's me. I will fix it. And sure, the programs continue, and he becomes the corporate knowledge of where your gaps and where your problems are. Most of us, if we're not responsible in that area, oh, this is a problem, then we're gone, and we don't think about it again until the next situation arises. Planners document the how-to of an emergency response. They identify who, what, when, where, and how, and what most of us do not is how much. If you got a plan and all you say generally, this is what we do, you don't really have a plan. You just have a concept of operation. You need to be able to resource it. This is what we need, how much we need. And where this fits into is that is your... There's two types of plans, deliberate and crisis. Deliberate planning is really, you're taking your worst situation, what your big deal is that you got to be prepared for. And it becomes a programming and budgeting tool, really, if you want to think about it that way. And that's really how we ought to probably look at it, especially in the days of decreased resources. Because you have, this is what we have to do, this is what we need to do it. And matter of fact, this plan was signed by the governor or whoever that authority is. So that gives you a lot of clout to go for the money and stuff and the resources that you need to have an executable plan. And the overall goal is you want to have a capability. That's really what you're doing this for, is to have a capability, not something that you file on plan in your shelf so that when an inspector comes by, it's like, oh, yeah, we have something, This is really what a planner does. He pulls a program together. And I put these things here. This is really the planning cycle. But I'm not going to bore you with the details, but a couple little things that you need to think about is that first you got to decide what your problem is. Well-define that. And the people usually you work with can pretty much tell you that. You may have to go to the intel community or something like that. But by and large, most of the disasters that I've worked with, sitting around the table beforehand, planning and brainstorming, you usually figure those things out pretty well. Then you write a plan. A plan is not a plan until you do the functional capability where you have to have the resources. You have to resource it. Manpower, equipment, and training. And if you don't have those assets, then you just got a fictitious novel, basically. You don't have the capability. Then you got to train your people, and we'll go into all these things. But and then you got to test and evaluate. You don't know that the plan really works until you test it. And I'll get into that just a little bit more. Current situation, at least what I've seen around the country, has been, some places have a planner. They can tell you the person's name. However, as his responsibility or her responsibility, along with everything else, you're assigned that responsibility. However, you got to maintain and do your normal duty first and foremost and stuff. So it becomes secondary duty and get secondary attention. Veterinarians particularly are not trained in managing a program. We're trained in to respond, to do the first responder type of things. Treat the disease, treat the outbreak, but how do you manage the program, get the resources, and put the people to implement them? Eisenhower probably said it as well as anybody, was that plans are worthless. Surprised to hear me say that up here. But planning is everything. What he's getting at there is that, yes, you can have this long document of 200 pages, but if you don't know what it says, have it written down, and nobody knows it, you have nothing. Where the plan is worth its weight in gold is the thought process that you go through to determine what do we do, why do we do it, and why is it important, and what are all our alternatives, what are our courses of action that we can do. And that was by General Eisenhower. But that's only a piece of the puzzle. There's another person well known that probably didn't know he was speaking about readiness at the time. But this is the part about exercise. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It is what you know for sure that just ain't so. And that was Mark Twain. So unless you exercise it, you may think you very well say, oh, well, we know this. But until you exercise, well, hey, that doesn't work. You know, we're going to have to start over on that one, you know, and stuff. So, but anyway, Mark Twain did do a valuable contribution to planning. So what? You say, well, Marvin, you're sitting up here. Hey, you say some good words. You know, we've got to put effort into it. But says, I have to go home tomorrow, and I got to get back to work. So how do I do that? Incremental, like everything else, a lot. You know, first of all, short term, you got priority. If you're in charge of this person who's a planner, give him some time, a priority that this is really a job that he needs to do. And then for a little bit longer is that you can fund for grant funding. If you're a state or local entity, grant funding is a possibility. People do get supported for several years for a planner. And what is good about that was that writes your justification for the rest of your program. And then for long term is that we need public health planners. We do not need other people planning for us and telling us what to do. We need to be able to say, this is what we need, this is why we need it. And so you can go in and not only do a good job, but get the resources you need, what have you. We need to train those people. And there's a lot about this world that you really don't know until you get into it. Most of us all learned it by school of hard knocks, but there are good training programs out there now that are being developed. Also, career track. Career track, not necessarily that this is the job and all that they do, but at first the person needs to be able to respond to the incident. Then as time goes on, later in his career, he will be the commander of this response team. And then later on in the career, he will be responsible for organizing the program, managing the program to make sure he has the resources, the people are trained, and what have you. So there's a progression in there. And we need to be able to be ready to do each one of those as we go through. And each one builds upon the other. I'd like to sort of end this today to make a point. It's a story, but I think it hits home to where I want to go with this, is that there was this guy named, and we'll call him Bob for this story, and he was an outstanding person. Basically, that's about all you can say about him. In high school, he was the quarterback. He was the captain of the swimming team, and senior class president, what have you. He everything and did everything well. Academically, he did well too. Went off to college. It was a lot of the same things again, is that he was on the football team. He did well academically and socially. And all the girls loved him, you know, and boys like me usually hated him, you know, and stuff. And after he graduated from college, he got married, had a beautiful family, two sons, as a matter of fact. And he was very enthusiastic. He was still an outdoors person, very macho. And he couldn't wait till his sons were old enough to follow in his footsteps and do the same things. And so when Noah's oldest son hit 10 years of age, he said, "Let's take him on one of our trips with his friends." And that was every year they would go to Alaska and go on a camping, hunting, fishing trip, you know, and stuff. So boy's 10 years old, so we'll introduce him to manhood and stuff. So they went out and they flew up to Alaska, and then one of his friends was a pilot. They would rent a plane similar to this, and they would go back to an inlet off the ocean where they always went. And anyway, so they spent several days there, and it was a wonderful time. You know, the hunting was great. They had bagged a lot of trophies. Had a wonderful time sitting around the campfire at night talking and reminiscing the old days and stuff and telling son how life will be and stuff. Matter of fact, they had such a good time that they didn't want it to end. So they decided to stay an extra day. Said, instead of leaving this afternoon, we'll spend the night again and leave in the morning. So the next morning when they got up, they loaded the plane and we got a lot of trophies here. Had such a good time, we don't want to leave them. And so put them in the plane. Of course, by delaying the flight, instead of the tide being in, the inlet being full, tide was going out. So when they taxied, they couldn't get all the way to the end. And but anyway, they've been out here many times and stuff. So and the plane was, the pontoons were deeper in the water, so they were struggling to lift off and get out. And it just wasn't gaining altitude, and all of a sudden, bam, one pontoon hit a wave, flipped it, and they were in the water. Alaska water's cold. They all were able to make it out of the plane, and the two men, the friends, they weren't as athletic as Bob. They swam, trying to save themselves against the current and stuff. So, and then as they drug themselves up on the beach, and they looked around for Bob in there. They looked back out in the ocean, and Bob was out there, and he was calling to his son, says, "Come, swim, swim harder. Dad, I can't. I can't swim anymore." And he said, you got to, son, come. And the guys on the shore started. I said, Bob, save yourself, come on. And he looked back at his son, he said, "I can't, Dad." He says, "Help me." And so Bob looked back ashore again, and then he turned around and swam to his son. Grabbed him in his arms, and that was what they saw when he went down the last time. Now, it's a terrible story, a terrible ending, in a way. But the problem that happened, the reason this fatal injury, was not because of the decisions they made then, that day. These decisions were made the day before, when they decided not to leave on time, when they decided they would go ahead and load their plane heavily and take the bounds. They had a plan, but they didn't do the planning, which is, this is what we do and why we do it. And that is my message today to you, is that I plead, do the planning and don't let a disaster like this happen to you. Thank you.